Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we will hear from bioethicist Bonnie Steinbach's keynote address at a philosophy conference at the University of Central Oklahoma on the 14th of April, 2000. Bonnie Steinbach is a member of the Department of Philosophy at the University of Albany, SUNY, and author of numerous books and articles on reproductive ethics.
One of the reasons why people have had problems with assisted reproductive technologies is because they raise the possibility of bifurcating the reproductive and rearing aspects of having children. And this is ironic in a way because art was developed to satisfy the desire of couples to have their own biologically related children. It's ironic because the very technology that was developed to satisfy that desire also enables people to have children who don't have any biological tie to them. This happened in a recent California case known as In Re Buzanca, where the couple used sperm donation, egg donation, and a surrogate, creating two fathers, genetic father and intended rearing father, and three mothers, genetic, gestational, and intended rearing. It could have worked out, but it became complicated when the couple divorced. And then Mr. Buzanca, who was the intended rearing father, refused to pay child support to the resulting child on the ground that it was not a child of the marriage. The first court agreed and said that, in fact, the little girl who was born as a result of all of this, JC, had no legal parents, and that the woman who had been raising her would have to adopt her since she was neither the child's genetic nor gestational mother. Fortunately, in my view, the appeals court overturned that decision and held that the people who brought about the creation of this child were the child's lawful parents. The woman who had been rearing her, Luann Buzanca, was her lawful mother and didn't have to adopt her. And they sent it back to the court to sort out the question of child support. The court issued a plea to the legislature to sort out the parent rights and responsibilities of those involved in artificial reproduction, saying, no matter what one thinks of artificial insemination, traditional and gestational surrogacy in all its permutations, and as now appears in the not-too-distant future, cloning and even gene splicing, courts are still going to be faced with the problem of determining legal parentage. A child cannot be ignored. Even if all means of artificial reproduction were outlawed with draconian criminal penalties visited on the doctors and parties involved, courts will still be called upon to decide who the lawful parents really are and who, other than the taxpayers, is obligated to provide maintenance support for the child. These cases will not go away. Okay, so one of the reasons we have to rethink reproduction is because these technologies make us rethink, what is it to be a mother? What is it to be a father? What is it to be a family? How important is biological connection? How important genetic connection? And how important is rearing? That's one set of problems. Related to that is the fact that these new technologies permit the creation of what we might call non-traditional families. You don't have to be a heterosexual couple anymore to have a child. So, for example, two lesbian women, a couple, can decide that they want to have a child and might have one through artificial insemination by donor. What happens then if they split up? Who has any right to the child? It might be argued that in not basing parenthood on biology, we really open the floodgates to some very undesirable consequences. I mean, you hire a babysitter and then later she says, hey, I want joint custody because after all, I helped raise these kids. One way to avoid these results is to insist that custody and visitation rights should be limited to the spouse of the biological parent, so long as that spouse has played a rearing role. So, for example, if a couple uses artificial insemination by donor to have a child, and then they get divorced, the wife can't say to the husband, you have nothing to do with these children who you've diapered and sat up with at night, etc., because I don't want you in my life anymore. He still is the children's legal father, and he's the legal father through the relationship to the mother. He's married to her. That's what gives him the right. Of course, that wouldn't work for lesbians because they can't get married, except in Vermont. But that seems to me actually a good reason for allowing them to get married. Because after all, if people are going to have children together, isn't it better that they do it in the context of a stable and state-recognized union like marriage? Well, some people are very upset by these possibilities that are created by art, the multiple parents, the gay parents, all of that sort of thing. And they argue that we should stick to the normal ways of having children where as the church has put it, the unitive and procreative functions are kept together rather than allowed to separate. Now, Leon Cass is a physician who has objected to art. Partly he's worried about the possibility of multiple parents, but he also talks about the muddying of lineage and kinship. That's true, there is that possibility, but it certainly isn't unique to art. We have the same problem in contemporary society with blended families, with divorce and remarriage, and families in which children have different parents and numerous grandparents. And actually, these days, when your students come to you and say that their fifth grandparent has died in one semester, it might even be true, right? Okay. And we have custody battles here, and we have distressing situations like an adopted child being wrenched out of the arms of its adoptive parents to be returned to the biological parents, baby Jessica and baby Richard, and even the switched baby case of Callie, Marie, and Rebecca. So the solution may not be to insist that these things can't happen, but maybe perhaps to recognize that not all families can be forced into the same cookie-cutter, two-parent, two-gender model. Some children have more than one mother. Some have more than one father. And recognizing this fact of modern life, courts might be better off not deciding who is the real mother and the real father. As law professor Alto Chera has written, it's been said you can never be too rich or too thin. Shall we add, perhaps, that you can never have too many parents to love you? Another objection to art comes under the heading of commercialization. For example, Canada's Royal Commission on New Reproductive Technologies took a rather absolutist position about this, saying certain aspects of the human experience must never be commercialized. In particular, human beings, their reproductive capacities or tissues should not be treated as commodities to be traded for money or other goods. And therefore, they recommended that there be no selling of eggs or sperm or embryos and no financial incentives in preconception or adoption arrangements. Now, one question this raises for me is, why is it commercialization and objectionable only when the individuals who are getting paid are the doctors and the nurses and the technicians, but never the people who are actually providing the reproductive tissues and capacities? I suspect that this catchphrase commercialization really expresses some deeper concerns, and here let me say what some of them are. One concern that it may be is the protection of potential donors. The money that is paid to young women for quote-unquote donating their eggs, it's not really donation, is it, but we'll just use the common term. I mean, it's selling, right? Which is typically between $2,000 and $5,000, incidentally taxable income, not always told to egg donors before they get the money, may be so tempting. I mean, $2,000, $5,000, you could probably go to Europe on that. that they won't think sufficiently about the potential health risks from superovulatory drugs and invasive techniques to remove eggs. And these health risks are real. They may not be very common, but they can be pretty disastrous. So somebody might say, look, it's the same reason why we don't let people sell their kidneys. It's a choice we don't want people to be able to make because they may be tempted to do something harmful to themselves for the money. Of course, some people think that even prohibiting the sale of kidneys is paternalistic and people ought to be able to make those decisions for themselves. And there's actually, this isn't such a bad argument. I mean, after all, we do let people donate kidneys to their relatives. So if it's okay for people to decide that the risk to themselves is worth taking in order to donate a kidney to a relative, why shouldn't they be able to decide for themselves that the same risk is worth doing it for the money, for the $2,000 or the $5,000, which, after all, might be used to buy health care for a relative? I mean, why is it that we say one is okay and not the other? And even if you think we should probably hold on to the kidney-selling prohibition, why should the same apply to eggs? After all, you only have two kidneys, but you have, you know, thousands of eggs. You're not going to run out, even though they're not, strictly speaking, renewable. There's a justice issue here as well, which is it fair to ask young women to go through the pain and the risk of egg donation without fair compensation? I mean, when men donate sperm, and they usually get paid, I think these days, about $50. It used to be $25. I mean, you know, that's 15 minutes in a Playboy magazine. It's not exactly something you need enormous compensation for, but egg donation is very time-consuming and quite painful. And finally, there's a utilitarian question that gets raised too, and that is, without financial compensation, there would be very few egg donors. I mean, in countries that don't allow financial compensation, either you can't get eggs or there's long waiting lists, as in the UK. And so we might ask ourselves this, that is a market in eggs so wrong that it must be forbidden, even if this thwarts the ability of some women to have a child? So that's one concern, I think, that people have that might come under commercialization. The other objection concerns the idea that buying eggs somehow commodifies children, turns children into products to be bought. I think this was demonstrated in a recent story from the newspapers, which I'm sure you've all heard about a couple that offered $50,000 from eggs from a young woman if she was over 5'10" and had SAT scores of over 1,400. I have a ad here, actually, that somebody at the New York State Task Force got for us, which tops that. It says, "Special egg donor needed. Preferred donor will meet the following criteria: height approximately 5'6" or taller, Caucasian, SAT score around 1250 or high ACT, college student or graduate under 30, no genetic medical issues, $80,000 compensation, paid to you and or the charity of your choice. All related expenses will be paid in addition to your compensation. Extra compensation available for someone who might be especially gifted in athletics, science, mathematics, or music." This ad is being placed for a particular client and is not soliciting eggs for a donor bank, because apparently some of these ads have really been actually, fraudulent. They're just trying to get a list of potential donors. And this appeared in the Daily Californian this March. Okay. There's no way that you can think about the $80,000 as a compensation for risks, time, you know, burdens and things like that, because after all, there's no more risks, no more pain, no more time, whether you give somebody $2,000 or whether you're going to give her $80,000. It's buying eggs of a certain desirable genetic type. And this raises the question about whether there's something morally objectionable about what might be called having children to spec, right? Here, it's clear that what potential parents are trying to do is determine what kind of offspring they have. There was a cartoon, I can't remember whether it was in the New Yorker, I guess it was in the New York Times News of the Week where they got it from, I'm not sure, which showed a baby in a cradle, two parents leaning over the cradle, the mother saying, "We picked eggs from a exceptional, a beautiful model for you," and the father saying, "And we got sperm from a Nobel Prize winner," and the kid has a bubble over him thinking, "Why would I want anything to do with these stupid, ugly people?" So may bounce back here.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, we are listening to an address by bioethicist Bonnie Steinbach at the University of Central Oklahoma on the 14th of April, 2000.
So clearly what this is doing is trying to determine what your offspring will be like. Another possibility goes back to this genetic engineering that I talked about earlier. We might at some point be able to change the characteristics of our offspring through genetic intervention into the very early embryo. Sometimes this has been called gene therapy, although I hasten to tell you right away that there has never been a case of any genetic disease being cured by intervention into the early embryo. There has been no genuine therapy. But it's still a possibility, and it may someday come to pass. Nor is it likely to stop with the curing of disease. Undoubtedly, if we can find ways to intervene so that we can make individuals have characteristics like being taller, brighter, cuter, whatever, more curious, less shy, whatever the characteristics that people think would be a good thing, there are going to be individuals who will want to purchase this. Now, I think the reaction of most people to things like this ad in the Daily Cal, or the one about $50,000 for a tall one, or the one on the internet with the model's eggs, is a very negative one. People are very distressed by this idea. But I think it bears looking at a little bit more as to exactly what are the objections. One kind of objection is simply that these people are living in a world of dreams if they think that you can actually design your children by buying eggs of a certain sort. This reminds me of the old story about George Bernard Shaw, who was sitting next to an actress at dinner who suggested to him that they have a child together. She said, "Think what a wonderful child it would be with my looks and your brains." And he said, "Yes, madam, but what if it had my looks and your brains?" And that ended that discussion. But that, of course, can't be an objection to a moral objection to buying eggs. I mean, you might just tell people, you know, you can buy the eggs of the model, but it still might look like your, 5'2" balding husband. You got to realize that can happen. So that would be just a question that it might be imprudent, but not wrong. I think another thing that upsets people is that this notion of trying to determine what your children will be like, to the extent that you're willing to pay $80,000 for eggs of somebody with a certain characteristic, distorts our ideal of parenting. Parents are supposed to love their children unconditionally, or as close to unconditionally as we imperfect beings can get. So you might dream of having a child who will go to Princeton, or be an ice skater, ice dancer, or play for the NBA. But if you get a kid who is, kind of short and not very athletic, you're supposed to love that kid anyway. And maybe if you've spent $80,000 trying to make sure that it won't be that way, you might not be able to be the kind of parent we would like you to be. However, having tried to express that objection, it seems to me that there are all kinds of parents who put unrealistic and unfair expectations on their children. They hire tutors so that the kids can get the SATs that'll get them into Princeton. They force them into playing sports that the kids don't even really want to play. And I have to wonder whether the activity between doing these kinds of things and buying genetic traits is as sharp as all that. Isn't really the criticism of parents who will just not accept their children for what they are the point rather than how you go about doing this? Another objection to both genetic intervention, should it become a realistic possibility, and possibly the buying of eggs. Incidentally, footnote here, you know, they've had this Nobel Sperm Bank for many, many more years than the possibility of egg donation. You know about this, right, where the Nobel Prize winners would donate their sperm. And it never got the media attention than egg donation. Now, this is an era for feminist reflection, isn't it? Why is it? Is it that eggs are sometimes because they're bigger? I mean, what is it about that, that they got all upset about buying eggs? But anyway. The other objection, however, to designing children is this word eugenics. We all know what's wrong with eugenics. It's coupled with a racist ideology which led to the sterilization of thousands of mentally disabled people in America, in Sweden, and in France. And in Europe, it led to the Nazi euthanasia program and ultimately the Holocaust. But, you know, I think some distinctions here are in order. The word eugenics is terrifying because of its history, and no one's suggesting that we should ever forget that history. But nevertheless, is eugenics, taken in its most narrow sense, which is the attempt to improve a species through biological means, through breeding, is it intrinsically wrong, or is it only wrong when it's coupled with a racist ideology? I want to suggest that there's nothing wrong with the goals of eliminating disease and disability and promoting health. And I think that if we could prevent children from having crippling diseases like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia, if we could enable them to be born healthy by changing genes at the earliest embryonic stages without side effects, obviously, that would be a very good thing. I don't think that there's any necessary path from eliminating disease to the Holocaust. Some disability rights advocates would disagree with me about that. They reject what they call the medical model, which looks at disability and disease as something to be corrected. They say, we don't need to be corrected. We're fine as we are. Change society so that it's more welcoming and accepting of us. Now, I certainly think we have a lot to learn from the disability critique about accepting people where they are, but I don't think that that's inconsistent with attempting to prevent disability and disease. Because look, think of it this way. If you take it to its extreme, this disability argument would suggest that there's nothing wrong with a pregnant woman, say, binge drinking and having a child who is mentally retarded due to fetal alcohol syndrome. You would just say, okay, so the kid's mentally retarded. Nothing wrong with that, just different. Well, I suggest we would say, there is something wrong with what you did. This could have been prevented. Or most recently, we found that smoking during pregnancy not only causes low birth weight and all the things that are associated with that, but cleft palate as well. So I disagree. I think we can make our society more open to people with disabilities and at the same time trying to prevent disease and disability. But what about enhancement? Because as I said, we're not going to stop with genetic engineering at curing disease. It's always this the possibility that's going to be used for non-health related characteristic. Isn't there something creepy about the deliberate attempt to create a super race of people? If parents get to choose, aren't they going to opt for kids who are taller, smarter, stronger, with blonde hair and blue eyes? And then there's the worry about those who have not been genetically enhanced. Won't we be creating or at least exacerbating already present social advantages with disastrous results for diversity, equality, and social justice? Now, I don't want to completely dismiss those kinds of concerns. I think they are there, although I personally think there's nothing wrong with kids who are shorter and darker. But I think that there is a bit of a disturbing tendency to focus on technology and to worry about social justice there, when it seems to me there are far greater threats to social justice from the facts that so many children go to inadequate inner city schools while other kids are going to well-financed suburban schools. I think we should worry much more about societal structures and less about these sexy high-tech interventions, which after all are probably not going to work so well anyway. Now, let me turn to some of the other interesting ideas about assisted reproductive technologies, which have raised puzzles. For example, you don't have to be young to have babies anymore, as you all know. There's this possibility of postmenopausal pregnancy. Women have given birth who were 63 and 64. Now, why anyone would want to do that, we won't even get into, but it is possible. One of the questions, I suppose, is about this is, well, what about the children, though? We know what the mother wants, or the prospective mother. What about the children? And I actually have a whole lecture on that, but I'm just going to give you the very quick rundown of what the problem with this is. The problem with thinking about the children is that the child has no other way of being born except in the situation which is alleged to be harmful or some way disadvantageous. In this case, the disadvantage obviously is not having a father. But it's not as if the kid could have had a father. It's life without father or no life at all. And this has raised some metaphysical problems about whether you can ever say that life is so bad that it would be better never to have been born. I actually think that this is kind of a false way of thinking about it. I think that from the perspective of preconception, you don't have to think about the fact that the kid once here will probably have an okay life. I think that never bringing children into existence doesn't harm them, but once they're here, they might have a fairly tough time of it. So if it can be avoided, I think it would be better. So I want to conclude then, and we can raise as many questions as you like about this or cloning or whatever you want in the discussion period. I want to conclude by saying that somebody at lunch asked me, so are you opposed to the reproductive technologies? And my answer to that is no. I think the acceptability of any potential reproductive technology depends on the intentions and motivations with which it's done and the likely consequences of doing it. New reproductive technologies do raise new ethical issues. Sometimes they force us to rethink very basic concepts like motherhood, fatherhood, family. Sometimes they call into question the very meaning of reproduction. But although they raise new questions, the basic ethical principles have not changed. Avoidance of harm, respect for persons, the wrongness of deception, coercion, and exploitation. These time-honored principles can help us navigate through the new ethical issues created by medicine at the beginning of life.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, we've been listening to an address by bioethicist Bonnie Steinbach at the University of Central Oklahoma on the 14th of April, 2000. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.